Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. I want to keep you updated on all the transfer payment programs that the city of Chicago is rolling out. Don't suggest that Mayor Triple Threat is trying to buy votes than previous mayors in Chicago did. But Chicago Moves will issue up to 50,000 prepaid gas cards of $150 and 100,000 prepaid transit cards of $50 to eligible residents across the city.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line 646-36, type in DA, then a quick comment. Yeah, it barely passed the city council yesterday, but a big point of contention was that on this gas card, and you can only use it, this $150 at a gas station, and it's non-transferable, so you can't sell it to your cousin, you know, for $100. It says her name on it, Mayor Lightfoot.
Do we have any criticism of this program? Like, I hear criticism when Willie Wilson gives away his own money to fill up people's tanks. Willie Wilson's buying votes. He's handing out money in churches so people can buy groceries. Willie Wilson's handing out his own money so people can fill up their tank with $50 of gas. Willie Wilson's trying to buy votes. He's just running for mayor. But when the government rolls out a program, isn't this wonderful public service?
Yeah, there was pushback from the usuals. Brendan Riley, your alderman, Alderman Lopez, and a few others. Because, you know, it wasn't, you know, party line. Well, everybody's a Democrat. But there was some pushback.
The city council, please. Pushback in the city council, those phrases don't belong in the same sentence. Pushback in the city council. If I had a nickel for every time I've heard that over the last 50 years, I would have a nickel.
Well, some people wanted her to use the $12 million in, you know, other areas, you know, for food subsidies and all that.
Right. Other people had other ideas to transfer money from other people to the same people for other things so that they could have their own press release and perhaps so they could create a new bureaucracy or expand an existing bureaucracy because they got a couple of idiot nephews who need summer jobs.
Well, it passed 26 to 23.
And? 75% of these cards will prioritize residents in community areas that face higher mobility hardship. How will you know? The government will tell you. The remaining 25% of cards will be distributed citywide in equal amounts to each ward. Well, that's wonderful. Every feudal lord gets their own cut, gets an equal share to distribute so that they can attach their name to the distribution of, you know, other people's stuff. Isn't that wonderful?
And you don't have to be a legal resident. You can be here illegally.
Of course, it's a sanctuary state.
Yeah,
a person can't be illegal, so we don't make those distinctions. So it's not even it's an affront to even bring that up.
Well, you have to apply online or in person at the Chicago Public Library. You have to have. Are you ready? If you want a gas card, you have to have a current valid city sticker, which costs about $125. So there goes your free gas if you don't have one.
Yeah.
And so it's a lottery pretty much across the entire city. But, right. Yes, you have to apply.
Blood out of one arm, we put it in the other arm, and we spill half of it in the process. Right, that's government. This week it was announced, we mentioned this when the idea was first rolled out. Now it's become reality. Wonderful. Chicago residents now able to apply for the city's new basic income program. Mm-hmm. That's 5,000 low-income households who will benefit from the Chicago Resilient Communities pilot program. Because, as Triple Threat said, she has the biggest penis in town. In addition to that, she also said, I remain committed to making an equitable recovery from the pandemic to stabilize and ensure the well-being and blah, 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 blah. Oh, meanwhile, your rent's doubling. The largest monthly cash assistance program in the nation, right here in Chicago. Aren't you proud?
Yeah, $500 a month.
$500 a month, 12 months, that's $6,000, according to the old math. Of the 5,000 that are available, 74,000 Chicagoans have applied since Monday morning when the application period commenced.
Huh. And another thing that happened yesterday, Dan, you're safer in your neighborhood. In River North, the Cook County Sheriff's Department opened an office, just a field office, right in the heart of, right near Boss Bar, 500 North Clark there.
Provide transport service for Brendan Riley to go home at night?
No, this is what they're going to do. Here's the sheriff. This is big stuff, Dan. 100 officers or sheriff's deputies are going to be roaming the streets. He'll explain.
Our goal is to be multifaceted. We're going to be doing from traffic to interacting with tourists, citizens, right. The merchants. We're going to have a unit that's going to be going up and down Michigan Avenue talking with the merchants on a daily basis. And we're going to have traditional police.
Yeah, and it's tourists, too, so it's Instagram moments. And literally, Superintendent Brown, everybody that got up there and spoke yesterday said, we want the tourists. It was all about the tourists and residents to feel safe. Because I just met this one man, Arturo, who he lives in your neighborhood, and he doesn't even go out to restaurants anymore at night. When it gets dark, he goes inside.
We don't go out for dinner anymore.
Really?
Because it's completely insecure.
So this sheriff's field office, who's heading that up? Rokan?
Yeah, he's part of the sheriff's department now. He's got a gun too now and everything. I talked to him yesterday.
Real gun?
It's not a squirt gun, Dan. It's a real gun. And they're already helping because they've been quietly operating. So I asked, Dart. I said, well, what have you accomplished? What have you done anything so far? And this is great. They're helping gunshot victims.
Yeah, we've been involved with arrests. There was a shooting recently where one of our officers was, just because we were so close and where it happened, we were the first one there to actually do the life-saving part of it.
Oh, that's good.
With tourniquets and stuff to keep the individual from dying.
Yeah.
I'm Cook County Sheriff's Police, the officers, I have respect for the job they do. Tom Dart. Stick to those puppy rescues and the photo ops. Just stay in your lane. We're talking about...
trying to help. They're working together, Dan. This is a collaborative effort. Everyone's excited about it.
Right. If you think that Tom Dart is a serious law enforcement official, then you probably also think Rokan is. Rich in Indian Head Park.
Oh, yes. Good morning, Dan. Good morning, Amy. One thing I have to say is I think that the money should be used to get more security for the people in Chicago and not be used for something that's temporary like this. They have to look to the long term by making the city
temporary. Who says it's temporary? It's a pilot program, and we're going to make this permanent scale.
Well, look
at all the demand. Thanks for the call, Rich. Brandy Nazi, who heads up the Chicago Department of Family and Support Services, that's a fancy name for a welfare agency. Mm-hmm. We're just really excited that people are interested in this program. Oh, really? People are interested in getting $6,000 for free? God, boy, I tell you, it's so innovative. Who would have thought that people would line up to get $500 a month to do nothing? Wow.
I know somebody who got the $500.
Is her name Amy Jacobson?
No, I didn't. Just because I got an EBT card during the pandemic doesn't mean that I apply for every government assistance program that's out there. They gave every, no matter of income, Dan, parent of CPS got an EBT card for each child that they have in CPS.
It's wonderful.
That $934 a month was wonderful.
Yes.
But I knew on the long end that I go, this is going to come back and bite me in the butt, guys. I told the kids, and I was right.
Well, they call that other program with the gas cards and the transit cards, they call that Chicago Moves. Both of these programs should be filed under the title Chicago Moving Out, because it's stuff like this that's why. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
before you see it on TV, share it on Facebook, or read about it in the paper. Hear it here first. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. What's your SOGI?
Excuse me, is that a personal question?
What is your SOGI? And do you have a crink in it? No, what's your SOGI? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 646-36DA, turnkey.pro text line. We all have a SOGI, and if you want to be inclusive, you got to use your SOGI.
What's a SOGI?
Use your SOGI or lose it.
What's my SOGI? Okay, SOGI meaning LGBTQ plus glossary of terms. Oh, it's what a SOGI definition. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Do you want to?
SOGI is your sexual orientation, gender identity expression. Your SOGI. Are you people not keeping up on this?
I didn't know what ice meant. Somebody told me what ice meant. Like my picture's ice. And I said, are you cold? What's going on? And you have bling. Okay, so SOGI is my sexual identity.
What's your SOGI? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 646-36-DA, turnkey.pro text line, sexual orientation, gender identity expression. We all have one, and use it. Use it or lose it. You know how I know this is important? Because PFLAG told me it was.
Oh, really?
Yeah, PFLAG told me about my SOGI.
Well, what are you doing to honor your SOGI, Dan, on the eve of your 50th birthday?
So PFLAG, of course, yes. You know about this too. PFLAG, parents, families, and friends of lesbians and gays, PFLAG.
Yeah, oh, you're right.
Yeah. So PFLAG is not just telling me about my SOGI. More importantly, teaching the kids. Joe Biden was at a little event for Teachers of the Year, some such thing, sponsored by the teachers' unions. And he had this to say yesterday about, the conversation we were having yesterday, the movie that's out. Whose children are they?
I think the greatest sin that anyone can commit is the abuse of power about our children. But it's true. They're all our children.
Yeah, he basically said the bite was cut.
I have it here, if you want to hear what he said.
Okay.
Made it public in the world. Have our students gain confidence enough to know what they can do, to reach in. We have an obligation. We have an obligation to help them teach and reach their potential. You've heard me say it many times about our children. But it's true. They're all our children. And the reason you're the Teachers of the Year is because you recognize that. Yeah. They're not somebody else's children. They're like yours when they're in the classroom.
There it is.
You represent a profession that helps them gain the confidence.
So they're your children when they're in the classroom. Is that true? They're really your children? 312-642-5600. Turnkey.pro answer line 646-36. Type in DA, then a quick comment.
They're not somebody else's children. They're our children, and they're your children, teachers, when they're in the classroom. That's exactly right. So, okay, so now let's go back. What are they doing in the classroom? Well, they're bringing in PFLAG to talk about your SOGI. This is a 25-page PowerPoint that is provided to Brooks Middle Schoolers in Bolingbrook. Brooks Middle School in Bolingbrook.
Okay.
25-page PowerPoint presented by a couple of identitarian hustlers from Naperville. Of course, they're from Naperville. Kristen and Peter Shulman are their names. They have lectured Brooks Middle School teachers about truths about being LGBTQIA. They have suggestions there how to demonstrate their support for PFLAG's positions on political issues. You know, little things you can do, like put a small rainbow flag on your desk, teacher. Uh-huh. Yeah. Let the child tell you their name and pronouns. Use your own pronouns to signal that you are an ally. Using the wrong pronouns imposes our assumptions on another individual. Mm-hmm. Teachers should eliminate the use of the words boys and girls. Refer to students as kids, class, or scholars. Scholars. And they should stop using moms and dads, replacing them with families and caring adults. To identify your classroom as a safe space, the Schulman said teachers should put a small rainbow flag on their desk or in their pencil holder and wear an ally button. They should also never use the word gay, as it might be offensive. No, we don't say this is just so gay. What we can do is make our classrooms more LGBTQ friendly. And then they go through a bunch of scenarios to help teachers advance that flag, quite literally, the P flag. Yeah. Brooks Middle School in Bolingbrook, 1,100 students. Yeah. Not great? That's what they're doing when they're there, when your kids are their kids. Marty in Naperville, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Not long from Naperville, Spring Hill, Florida. Here I come when my house is finally built.
There you go.
Anyway, I know what my SOGI is, but I got to tell you this. I wish when I was a senior in high school, 1976, I wish I would have thought of the idea that I feel like a girl. I got to go dress in a girl's locker room. Man, I wish I would have thought of that back then. So hey, maybe they got something going here. I don't know. But oh, well. Have a good show, guys.
Thanks for the call, Marty. Yeah, have maybe at the adult level, have anybody been pressured by their employer to include their preferred pronouns on their signature for professional emails?
I don't understand that at all. And the other place where I work, everybody does that. She, he, I don't know what that, I don't understand. Why do you have to put she, her? Because
you have to be an ally.
Well, but what does that, if it's coming from, if I have an email and I'm not being rude, I'm not being dismissive, I'm not being insensitive, but if I'm getting an email from a fellow female, why at the end she'll write her name or print her name, her title, and then put she, her, them. What does? Because it's coming from a woman, so why does she have to put that? I'm just asking if anybody wants to help me out.
Is this not straight? I mean, you don't know? Did you just listen to the slides from this PowerPoint? You don't know what their position is? You don't know what their position is.
No, if the email is coming from
because
a woman.
Because you can't assume gender. Well, this has not penetrated yet. There's no such thing as men and women. There's your SOGI. And to assume a female is a female or a male is a male is to make an ass out of you and the identitarian movement.
All right.
Are people confused about this? I mean, I'm stunned how many times it takes people to be beaten with a stick before they feel it. Brooks Middle School in Bolingbrook. You think this is ground zero? It's everywhere. You're describing it. There's not any thought given to what's afoot here.
Got an email from a listener. Hi, Dan and Amy. I have a coworker whose daughter attends Fremd as a sophomore. Just yesterday, she texted her dad from school saying she doesn't want to attend anymore because a guy just walked out of the girl's bathroom. She said this guy decided to wear a wig a few weeks ago and say he's a girl, so now he has complete access to girls' bathrooms and locker rooms.
Yeah, welcome to the party 3 years after we talked about the locker room issue at the Palatine High School District.
Yeah, same high school. I'm curious if students need to present any documentation from a doctor or therapist stating that they are transgender / transitioning. Or is it just how you feel? If you feel like a girl
therapist,
that day, you can just walk into the girl's bathroom.
Is that a rhetorical question?
Yes.
Does somebody really not know whether they are required to present a note from a doctor on this?
You don't have to.
Of course you don't have to.
Right. I was reading her email saying, do you have to? I was like, no, you don't. Because if you feel like a girl or a guy that day, you can go into the bathroom that you want to use.
Yeah, I can't believe we're losing to these guys. Well, actually, I can. From another slide here, from PFLAG, about your SOGI at Brooks Elementary. Am I speaking too fast? Pronouns define us. Pronouns should match our identities. Pronouns are important. Using the wrong pronouns imposes our assumption on another individual. It's not about us, it's about them.
Oh, that's right.
You got to educate.
It's like COVID. The mask isn't about me, it's about you. I'm helping you.
Let the child tell you their name and pronouns. Use your own pronouns to signal you're an ally. Hi, my name is Dan, and my pronouns are go pound sand. Mistakes are okay. It's all about your effort. Every LGBTQIA child has a story about being bullied. LGBTQ make up a large percentage of children in foster care with behavioral problems. Oh, boy, would I love to dig into that. 40% of trans youth reported a previous suicide attempt. 82% reported suicidal ideations or intent. Boy, would we like to dig into that. Oh, we have. Does anybody dig into or use what we've dug into or do some digging into themselves and respond when these jackals come to your kid's middle school? What about the teachers, since they're doing a train the trainer? That's what they're doing at Brooks and Bolingbrook. You know, have the teachers do the indoctrinating. Indoctrinate the teachers, they indoctrinate the kids. And that's how you take over the culture of a school. And remember, when your kids are in their possession, they're their kids. Karen Beecher.
Good morning. So, Dan, you are reading from the exact missive. Well, I got two missives on Holy Thursday at our staff meeting. One is from NYU. So, again, here we have people at a university level taking theories and applying them to elementary schools where we serve early childhood through fifth graders. That is completely unacceptable, in my opinion. And then also, too, the other missive is from the Anti-Defamation League, fighting hate for good, except for the hate for parents, because they want me to commit a sin of omission. The fourth commandment is honor thy mother and thy father. And they want me to keep any and all information regarding this trans inclusive practice hidden from the parents. Mm-hmm. I will not do that. And my super has for 2 years now, everything he sends out, he wants us to know his pronouns. I could give to
and this is in this is and where do you teach? What region or district?
Flossmoor.
Right. Yeah. Okay.
Kittywampus from one of your favorite golf courses.
Yeah. Okay. And so what do the other teachers say? What do your other faculty colleagues say about all this? Nothing?
When I saw these two misses, I stood up and I harumphed quite loudly. And everybody looked at me, and I walked out. I'm not putting up with this garbage. So now I receive the cold shoulder, mm-hmm. and I'm not included on this or that or this or that. And really, I could not care. But that we were given these missives on Holy Thursday, I thought, you know what? I'm sitting at a table with a bunch of betrayers. This is not why we entered the field of education. So I am leaving. July will be the last of my association with the school district because, Dan, I will not commit a sin of omission for that school district. I won't commit it for anybody. Well, okay, I lie about my weight, but whatever.
we'll give you a pass on that.
I'm not doing it. I'm just not doing it, and more people have to stand up. Was the only one out of 33 people, which is also a significant number, but whatever.
Yeah, thanks for the call, Karen. Appreciate it. Adam Midway.
Hello, this is Adam from Illinois. Yeah. I want to tell you, first of all, those children are not their children. They're the parents' children. They are their students. That's a big difference.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, good point. Okay, thanks for the call, Adam. No, I know. Don't tell me. Tell the big guy. Chris, Dan Ryan.
Hey, Dan. Hey, Dan and Amy. How you guys doing? I want to be known now as a pronoun for clown and clown self. That will be now my new pronoun. And the only acronyms I really want to hear about is PBR ASAP. That's the only acronyms I need to know now on.
I hope I make myself clear. You have a wonderful day.
Thanks, Chris. Mary Kay, Western Springs.
Hi, guys. You know, I can't even keep up with LBGQT. You know, A, B, C, X, Y, Z. Do they add things to it? Do they take away and keep changing it? Do you guys know? I mean, is it all? Do they?
Oh, it's ever expanding. Oh, sure, of course. Solidarity and marginality.
Oh. All right. Well, X, Y, Z. I hate it. Anyway, I'm a BASO. I am not a SOGI or whatever you said. I have a biologically assigned sexual preference. Then I'm a BASP.
BASP? BASP.
I'm a BASP.
Okay.
With a P, because I have a whatever. I mean, I hate the pronoun thing because that was in college, freshman year. Everybody got to put their pronouns outside their dorm rooms, which I thought was really bizarre. And the kids the freshmen were like, well, you know, that's okay. You know, some people are not, blah, blah. You know, some people want to be called this or that. It was a boys and girls floor, so I understood that. But all-girl floor, just put your names on the door. I don't care if you're a he, she, it, walrus, whatever you identify as. It doesn't matter to me, and it shouldn't matter to the rest of the kids. That shouldn't even come into their minds when they're meeting kids, choosing friends. It doesn't. Do you guys? Does it matter? I don't care if you're gay, straight, lesbian, transgender. I don't need to know. These people have been around forever, and you know, people who feel this way, they have gender dysmorphia. Just let them be. Go ahead.
Well, that's not one of the options. That's not leaving them be is not being an ally, you see. So you have a positive responsibility to be an ally. And if you're not celebrating, Mary Kay, then you're not being an ally. So we have to know about it. We have to learn about it. We have to celebrate it, and then we have to teach others to celebrate it. And anything short of that is you're suffering from one of the phobias, or you're practicing one of the isms. That's how it works.
I know. You are so right, and I am so wrong. I'm tired of the flags. I'm tired of the signs. I just want to rip them out of people's yards. I'm just getting I can't even look at it anymore. No human is illegal. No human is illegal. Science is
powerful.
Science
is science is also powerful.
Science.
If you say it, you sound smart too. You're very smart.
You sound empathetic, which is even better than sounding smart. Uh-huh. Thanks for the call, Mary Kay. Yeah, you
sound empathetic and intelligent.
You sound very, very sentimental. You've got such a big heart.
I just hope, you know, speaking of flags, I just hope come 4th of July that people put up that American flag again. You know,
mm-hmm.
I walked into East Bank Club yesterday. They had the hugest Ukrainian flag right there. And I'm like, that's so East Bank Club.
Right. Have you ever seen an American flag inside
Never.
East Bank Club?
No. Mm. No. June is the gay pride flag. No, I don't. No. 4th of July, I think they put it up.
Well, and to Mary Kay's point, you can run. They will chase you. So just understand that's the dynamic. And then you have to decide what to do when they chase you. And that's where people are at, including at Brooks Middle School in Bolingbrook.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer.
Your show keeps me alive during the week. There's nobody I'd rather listen to between 5 and 9 in the morning than you guys.
On AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy announced yesterday the Department of Homeland Security is setting up a new board designed to counter misinformation related to Homeland Security. The focus specifically on Russia, but not limited to. The board, entitled the Disinformation Governance Board, and it will be headed by Nina Jankowicz, who is a former Ukrainian policy advisor to some extent. I guess she was she did that as part of a Fulbright scholarship. Good for her. And, of course, it couldn't have be any other way. Nina Jankowicz, the new executive director of the Department of Homeland Security's Disinformation Governance Board, is what you would expect, a purveyor of disinformation. She rejected the Hunter Biden laptop story as a Russian disinformation campaign. She tweeted about it, in fact. So, but I mean, I'm not surprised by that. I would be surprised if that weren't the case, that the disinformation is coming from those charged with monitoring disinformation. That's how it goes in this Huxleyan world in which we live now, in which so many of us genuflect before the government. And this also should come as no surprise, because we had the Surgeon General, Dr. Vivek Murthy. Remember him last year? This is from July of last year, when he rolled out his truth ministry, you know, for COVID, but not limited to COVID when it comes to getting the science and data right. Safetyism is freedom.
On the dangers of health misinformation, Surgeon General advisories are reserved for urgent public health threats. And while those threats have often been related to what we eat, drink, and smoke, today we live in a world where misinformation poses an imminent and insidious threat to our nation's health. Health misinformation is false, inaccurate, or misleading information about health, according to the best evidence at the time. And while it often appears innocuous on social media apps, on retail sites, or search engines, the truth is that misinformation takes away our freedom to make informed decisions about our health and the health of our loved ones. During the COVID-19 pandemic, health misinformation has led people to resist wearing masks in high-risk settings. It's led them to turn down proven treatments and to choose not to get vaccinated. This has led to avoidable illnesses and death. Simply put, health information has cost us lives.
Mm-hmm. If the elimination of dissent can save just one life, isn't it worth it? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 646-36-DA, turnkey.pro text line. This is an all-of-society approach. I mean, start with something, you know, in a crisis with the pandemic, roll out the Surgeon General. We'll start with the easy part, health information. Get the health information right. Lives are on the line.
Did they get the health information right?
I don't think so. No. I don't think so. As you just heard Murthy mentioning some of the junk science that is coming from those with the big jobs in the public health sector. And so now it's spreading throughout government. Every agency needs its own misinformation governance board, because every agency has existential responsibilities to preserve Western civilization. So it's the Surgeon General when it comes to public health information, and it's the Department of Homeland Security when it comes to our national security. You're not opposed to protecting America's national security, are you? You're not opposed to saving lives, are you? All of society approach, Dr. Murthy.
Now, we need an all of society approach to fight misinformation, and that's why this advisory that I issued today has recommendations for everyone. First, we include recommendations for individuals and families. We ask people to raise the bar for sharing health information by checking sources before they share to ensure that information is backed by credible scientific sources.
Not by sources.
As we say in the advisory, if you're not sure, don't share.
If you're not sure, don't share.
Well, I think that they weren't sure, but they shared for 2.5 years.
That's another way of...
Of what?
I think that's a bit of a euphemistic way of saying, if you don't agree with us, don't share.
Exactly.
Don't share.
Don't even think about it, because then we could yank you off of social media, too, if we really don't like the information that you're giving.
If you're quoting
a doctor that we don't like, or, you know, that signed the Great Barrington Declaration.
So this was an all of Biden administration approach last year. This is last July.
Oh boy.
So I know there's this furor that erupted on social media yesterday about this. Nobody paying attention other than us, what Dr. Vivek Murthy and gang were doing back in July. Jen Psaki was trotted out to defend Murthy's truth ministry.
We've increased disinformation research and tracking within the Surgeon General's office. We're flagging problematic posts for Facebook that spread disinformation. We're working with doctors and medical professionals to connect to connected medical experts who are popular with their audiences with accurate information and boost trusted content. So we're helping get trusted content out there. We also created the COVID Community Corps to get factual information into the hands of local messengers. And we're also investing, as you all have seen, in the president's, the vice president's, and Dr. Fauci's time in meeting with influencers who also have large reaches to a lot of these target audiences who can spread and share accurate information. You saw an example of that yesterday. I believe that video will be out tomorrow.
Yeah, they bring in top 40 pop singers so that Joe Biden and Kamala Harris can tell them what the truth is and they can go out and post it on Instagram. Those are our helpers. Do you understand, proles? I mean, this is, going down the road to New Zealand. Christina Ardern, we are your single source of truth.
Oh, that's right. Remember that?
When it comes to, I mean, she was talking specifically about public health information pertaining to COVID, but I don't think she would limit herself as such. We are the truth. Right. Yeah. And, hey, we're going to provide this public service by ferreting out anything that is untrue, misinformation, because we're saving lives, because we're protecting America, because
it sounds like a communist country.
We're doing nothing short of saving democracy, you know, from the people.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment.
David Mamet, America's greatest living playwright. Do check out his book, Recessional, if you haven't. He was on Adam Carolla's podcast talking a bit about free speech and these so-called journalists. And he's talking about, in part, it is almost indistinguishable, the political press corps from the state flax from the political operatives. And Carolla asks him, or observes, you know, they've moved from going after speech to going after ideas. When they're going after a particular speech, they're really going after ideas. These are thought crimes. You know, again, all roads lead back to Orwell here, but Mamet's response.
Especially when you think about all that's gone on in the COVID era, someone having an idea about it, and they're going after ideas. And that feels much more Orwellian to me.
Well, it is Orwellian. They're a bunch of whores is what they are. They aren't journalists. They aren't newspaper people. They're a bunch of whores. And they're in the pay or in the pocket of the legacy media. And what they're doing is incredibly shameful. And so what I wanted to do in the book was call them out, say, wait a second, let's give it a name. It's not the road to totalitarianism. It is totalitarianism. And if we, who've benefited from free speech and benefited from the sacrifices of generations of Americans who died for free speech, are not going to speak up about it, then what we're doing is shameful.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636-DA, turnkey.pro text line, Lee in Hammond, Indiana.
Hey, guys. You know, I'm in my 70s, and the way I grew up, I'll decide what I think the truth is. You know, you've got a right to actually take the facts as you find them, and you make your own decisions. The only place that actually mandates what the truth is were totalitarian police states. As far as I'm concerned, I'll go to my grave believing that. And if they don't like it, it's too bad. It's just the way it is.
All right. Thanks for the call, Lee. Keith in Greenwood, Mississippi?
Yeah, hi. Hi, Dan and Amy. Good morning. Hey,
morning.
Listen, I thought it would be really interesting to get a total list of all of the disinformation articles that they've told and perpetuated, starting with Benghazi, because that's like the first time I noticed that the government was perpetuating a lie. And ever since then, almost everything on the news is disinformation. And I'd just like to get a total list of all of the articles that have been false. And
Yeah, I mean, thanks for the call, Keith. I mean, that you're adding to that list on a daily basis, to your point. I mean, it's so voluminous. I don't know that you could create a master list. You almost have to do it by category and just use the worst examples by category. You know, pick a misinformation campaign like what happened in Benghazi, you know, and I don't know, start with the movie. Something else Mamet said I wanted to get to, too. I think this was a great distillation. Very sharp mind, of course, David Mamet.
Iowa grad.
Shockingly.
Well, I know. I'm just letting you always rip on Iowa. And
I know.
It has produced a genius.
Well, you know, blind squirrels. Okay. So,
yes.
Carolla asks Mamet about Musk. You know, what about Musk? What is it about Musk the left fears? And this is a very succinct, well-thought-out analysis of what the left fears and how you know. Take a listen.
They're worried about exclusion. The anything, like I say, it's like living in a sick household where daddy is having sex with seven-year-old little Susie, right? The problem in that household is not that daddy is a pedophile and a rapist, but that nobody can mention the problem. That's the problem. Because if anyone mentions that problem, the family falls apart. You save little Susie, but the family falls apart. So everybody in that family is devoted to keeping the secret. So what we see from the left is everybody's devoted to keeping the secret. That's why what they fear most in the left... Look, it was Napoleon said, look at what your enemy tries to frighten you with. That's what he fears. Uh-huh. So what the enemy is trying to frighten us with, the left is trying to frighten us with, is exclusion. They think that's the worst thing in the world. Oops, if you say XYZ, you're out. If you say, because they're terrified of exclusion because their only power comes from the group.
Yeah. I mean, it's a graphic comparison that Mamet uses, but that's Mamet's style. Yeah. Right. Right on the mark. Exclusion, which is, you see some of the indications of the truth of that statement. We mentioned it yesterday. Sean King, one of these Black Lives Matter hustlers, announcing when Musk's takeover bid was accepted by the board, I'm closing my Twitter account, and then coming back the next day. You're not getting rid of me that easily.
You blankers.
Right. It's Alec Baldwin. I mean, Hollywood celebrities have been doing this for generations. Alec Baldwin was leaving
the country
right. in 1988 when George Herbert Walker Bush was elected president because George Herbert Walker Bush was a CIA killer, according to Alec Baldwin. Did Alec Baldwin leave the country? No.
Did they leave it when Trump was elected?
No.
And all those Hollywood elitists.
No.
I'm moving to Canada. Yeah. Go. You know what? Move to Canada. Go to Mexico. I don't care.
Right. The point, they cannot stand under their own two feet. As he said, their only power is in the group. And so they will never leave, certainly not voluntarily. And they'll perform like they have principle, but there is none. There's just the mob. There's just the swarm. And what they, and to his point, borrowing from Napoleon's insight into man, what they actually fear is their irrelevance. And their relevance comes from being part of the swarm. It's a really keen insight. It's important to understand that. It informs how you should approach these people. Bob, Buffalo Grove.
Thanks for taking my call, Dan and Amy. Question, when the Republicans take over the House and they resume the Congress in January, can they get Shifty Shift to testify where he got his Russia information?
Yeah, thanks for the call, Bob. We'll see. We'll see how Maybe. Stout of heart the Republicans are when it comes to the reckonings, if and when they gain control of both chambers, which I suspect is going to happen. If the election were held today, it would happen.
Right.
We'll see, though. Still a long way. Keeley, Western Burbs.
Hey, so my question really that I've been thinking about all morning is, what are these parameters that they plan on using to measure what disinformation is? I mean, I've seen so many articles come out that have been so hypocritical against themselves, saying that, oh, this is disinformation, but that very news company posted an article on that same matter, you know, years prior that had, you know, information regarding that. So that's my question.
Yeah, right. Well, that's that. Thanks for the call, Akili. Right. Who decides what the truth is? And they're telling you they do. And they're telling you they don't trust you to consume information with particularly information with which they disagree and come to your own determination.
Well, it sounds like state-run media.
Well, it is state-run media. They're also telling you they don't trust you to be a they don't trust you to live freely is what they're telling you.
To have your own thoughts.
Well, right. Live freely categorically. They're in charge of your lives.
Mm-hmm.
Just like when
your
kids are at school, they are not your kids. They're our kids. Right. We're the American people. We're not individual Americans. John, Milwaukee.
Good morning. They have taken away God, the family, and if you have an American flag out in front of your house, you are a domestic terrorist, and I have noticed in my lifetime that the government, and not only in my lifetime, in the past short years, that the government, my beloved church, and the medical community have all swung left. The idiots are running the asylum, and thank you both.
Thanks, John. Cassandra, Northwest Side.
Hi. You don't let the weak, the fearful, the demented run your world. But I think this all comes down to a fight that we've been having since the caves. It doesn't matter if you call it right and left, conservative, liberal. We've been having the fight of their people who hate freedom so much, for whatever their reasons, that they will kill you for wanting it. They will lock you up. They will torture you. They will shun you. Then you have people who love it so much, they will sacrifice themselves for someone else's freedom. And this is the fight we're having. It is that simple. And I do not believe the Republicans or the conservative movement is at all ready for the power they're about to get handed once again. So I'm a little doubtful about the outcomes.
All right.
Excuse me. Thank you for a wonderful show.
Thanks for the call, Cassandra. Appreciate it. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
Connect with Dan and Amy on the AM 560 The Answer mobile app. Just text the word app to 64636 to download the app today. This is Chicago's Morning Answer.
You know, this show isn't for everybody. If you're not interested in the truth, if you're not interested in having a conversation on the merits, then don't listen to this show.
On AM 560.
Because there's no place for you here.
The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So where are things for the midterms right now? I know it's a long way away and people don't obsess about elections seven months out the way that we do on this show. But
time flies. I mean, you blink, you guys, and it will be here.
Well, and also, I mean, all of the issues that I would think would be informing people's votes are playing out, and that has to have some impact on how you're thinking about your immediate future, your community's future, future of the country. So maybe it's time to do a little bit of a stop, look, and listen. A long time yet to go. Many things can happen. The unexpected is always expected. So these are just snapshots in time. But it is interesting to get a feel for where the momentum is by the way that the political parties and their flacks talk about the election and talk about one another. So a good gauge of where the left is right now, I can't think of anybody better to go to than a Republican congressman who converted to an MSNBC host.
Who would that be? Which
that
one?
That would be Joe Scarborough.
Oh, yes.
Here's what he said on his Morning Joe show.
It's Mika with Mika.
Yeah, Joika. Joika.
Joika. Oh, that's right. That's right.
Joe and Mika. Joika.
It's Damian Joika. Yes.
And then, you know, they got some ancillary players from, I don't know, from the D.C. press corps. They're interchangeable. Who cares?
Well, they have that one guy who's back after his sex scandal.
So here's Scarborough framing the 2022 election as far as the left is concerned.
This is what I was talking about at the beginning of the show, that 2022 is really going to be a referendum, not on Joe Biden. It's going to be a referendum on the Republican Party and the future of the Republican Party, especially when you look at some of the people that are running in the primary and some of the horrific things that they are saying. I mean, you just look at this number from Sam's poll. Only 38% of Republicans think that people uttering racist remarks are a roadblock, are a serious roadblock for the election. So only 38% think that it's a major problem. Less than half of Republicans believe that uttering anti-Semitic remarks, spewing anti-Semitic remarks, are a serious problem and a roadblock to being elected. That tells you a large chunk of the Republican Party right now, a large chunk of the Republican base I'm not exactly sure what word I've been using the word fascist for some time, that there is a fascist strain in the Republican Party for at least a third or so of those members.
So what's motivating you at this point come November or just generally to engage in the conversations we have on this program and to participate in the political process, as I know many of our listeners do? Are you enthusiastic about the prospect of Speaker McCarthy and a Senate Majority Leader McConnell and a springboard to 2024 and a President Trump Part two, or President DeSantis, or somebody else? Is it enthusiasm about defeating the incumbents and those in charge for the purposes of just sending a message to people like Joe Scarborough? Or is it because you're really excited about what's to come if a different party with a different policy agenda was in charge? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636-DA, turnkey.pro text line. In other words, DMA, do you just want to, electorally slap the smirk off Morning Joe's face? Or do you see that as just a ancillary benefit, the real focus being I want to see Republicans in charge to do X, Y, and Z? A little bit different. It's a little bit different motivations. By the way, the polling numbers that Scarborough was
referencing,
riffing on, completely disingenuous, of course. Because the point is, we need numbers so that we can call Republicans fascists and racists and homophobes and so forth. The questions were phrased in the poll such that not whether you think racist remarks or anti-gay remarks are wrong. It was, do you think that the presence of people or candidates saying racist things or anti-gay things is a significant problem? Is that a cultural problem we have? Is candidates running around uttering racist and anti-gay remarks? That's the question. And so, against the backdrop of other challenges facing Americans right now, from the prices for food and energy to
crime,
all sorts of other things that we can go through, it's putting it in that context. So his Jeremiad about can you believe only two in five Republicans think it's a problem to utter a racist remark? That's not what the question was saying. That's not what the question was soliciting. And that's not what the response is saying. It's saying it's not a significant problem. There's not a national crisis of candidates running around burning crosses and uttering racial epithets. And, of course, there isn't.
Right, because there isn't. But they associate all, things racist to January 6th.
So it's something else that's interesting, too. Scarborough, since he stood for election, you would think he'd know a thing or two about them and won a couple elections. Elections are almost always referenda on the incumbents. Now, sometimes you can flip the script, particularly if the challengers provide aid and comfort for allowing you to define the race about them. Mitt Romney allowing Obama to define the race about him in 2012 is a good example of that. But you've got to assist them. Otherwise, people, generally speaking, especially in the swing, are making assessments on the people in charge, what they've done, and how's it going for me. It's pretty linear. And the how's it going for me, based on what they've done, those numbers don't look great for the socialists right now, starting with the head of their party and the president of the United States. And so this is the effort that's underfoot to shift the focus, try to shift the focus on demagoguing the Republican Party based on a couple of individuals who made a couple of statements, and then to suggest that what you have is the threat of a looming white supremacist, homophobic takeover of our government, and we need to save democracy from these people. That's going to be their pitch, because that's all they have to pitch. What else are they going to pitch? How America has restored its standing in the world? How America is a safer, how the world is a safer place under Joe Biden? Are they going to pitch the purchasing power Americans are enjoying right now? Are they going to pitch tax relief? You're taking home more money. Are they going to pitch K through 12 education? Look at all we've done to improve K through 12 education. Are they going to pitch pandemic response? That looks worse and worse with each passing day to more and more, as Dan Henninger writes about in the Wall Street Journal yesterday. What do they have to pitch? They don't have much to pitch, so they have the boogeyman. And that's what Joe Scarborough is pitching.
Yeah, the boogeyman and misinformation. Those are their two new themes.
Right. Well, and they're connected, right?
Because it didn't work for them. So.
The boogeyman and the misinformation, the boogeymen are the purveyors of misinformation.
Ah, okay.
They're threatening our democracy. These racists and white supremacists. Elon Musk wants to take Twitter back to, a South African apartheid.
Oh, that's right, according to Sean King.
Lori in Sycamore. Hey, Lori.
Hi, Dan and Amy. Okay, just really quickly. I used to vote Democrat. I'm just so tired of all of them. They're so horrible. Learning about all the lies. And I know both sides lie and cheat and do terrible things. But it's just unbelievable what has happened in the last couple of years. And the thing that worries me about November is I want the Republicans and the conservatives, I don't even like the word Republican and Democrats. I think it should just be good versus evil. And I want them to turn everything around and get us back to normal. But my fear is that the candidates and everybody that we hope are strong, then they're going to cave and they're going to give in. And I think that's when we're going to have just huge more riots, even from the conservative side, because we have got to be strong, and we have got to make these people hold all these Democrats and leftists accountable, and it just scares the blank out of me.
Yeah,
that's all.
No.
Thank you.
Lori, thanks for the call. You know what I like about Sycamore, in addition to callers like Lori? I like two things that I think of when I think of Sycamore.
Suburb of DeKalb, yes.
I think of the Pumpkin Festival.
Oh, yeah. And the Turkey Testicle Festival.
And I in Sycamore?
Oh, no, that's the wrong town, sorry.
Yeah.
Where is the Turkey Testicle?
And I think of my golf club maker, Sub 70.
Oh.
Yeah.
Because you have a close relationship with those clubs.
Yeah. No,
do you sleep with your clubs, Dan?
I don't. It's a good outfit. Sub 70. This is the first time I've ever got fitted for golf clubs.
Really?
Our mutual friend Tom Meredith turned me on to these Sub 70 guys out in Sycamore.
Mm-hmm.
They're great sticks. They're like a poor man's PXG. Golfers will know what I'm talking about.
And they fit everything. Grip, height, club head size, everything.
Yeah, I mean, golfers will know what I mean by getting fitted for clubs.
Okay, I know what it means to be fitted for clubs, Dan.
Yeah. Grips.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. Okay, yes. Club head speed and and stance. And, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Have you ever been fitted for clubs?
Yes, I have been.
Have you?
Doesn't it was a show. Long time ago, but I was. And guess what? I still have those same clubs because I'm not spending money on golf clubs. I have other things, other children, mouths to feed.
Yes.
I can't be like you, Dan.
No. And, you know, you can't subsist on the $500 of free cash that Lori Lightfoot's giving you every month.
I didn't qualify and I didn't apply, okay?
What about the gas and transit cards? Did you get those?
No, I can't.
Amish Texter calling us on the Tin Can and String Hotline.
Special day.
Good morning. Yeah, by the way, Huntley is the home of the Turkey Tuscan.
Oh, that's right. Mm-hmm. Thank you. See, I knew you'd have the answer.
Uh-huh. The great people out in Huntley, that's right. But anyways, I think that
nobody
think
knows Turkey Tuscan like Amish, yeah.
I think we could channel the great Sam Kennison in an answer to Mr. Joe Scarborough and ask the question, is he right? Because I know a lot of people think he's right watching MSNBC, but I wasn't there. I was out there slugging it out with Charlie and the parents and the doggone, you know, school boards where they were grooming our kids at Disney, and I was there at the libraries with the doggone, you know, trans library hour. I was out home sitting there listening to TikTok videos or watching them.
All right, Amish. Thanks for the call.
I think that's a bit of a stretch, but you know.
You know, the problem is you get a master impressionist like Frank from Arlington Heights who calls in and does impressions, and then everybody thinks they're Rich Little. So, yeah. All right,
All right.
Frank, speaking of which, Frank in Arlington Heights.
Frank!
Richard, no house, sir. Maybe that wasn't that good. I was kind of on...
No, it's good.
Yeah, it was on the spur. Yeah. Would you prep for the show, please?
I will prep a little bit better. But I'm very positive on this whole thing with the election. One of the things we talk about in class in terms of elections is, you know, Reagan and FDR, how you both, even though they're on different ends of the political spectrum, and whether you may agree with one or the other more, you really have to respect both of them because of the electoral blowouts that they had. And both of those two presidents, if you look at 1932 and 1980, they both blowout wins and massive rejections of their predecessors. And then they had, in their reelections, massive affirmations by the public, by the American people, of their presidencies in 1936 and 1984. Big blowouts. And both of them also faced very
and
difficult
72.
Economic.
Yeah.
Well, 72 was Nixon. 72 is Nixon.
No, I know, but 49 states. 49 states in 72, 49 states for Reagan in 84.
Well, I'm talking about FDR, though, too.
Oh, yeah, right. Well, yeah, 32, yeah.
Yeah. What I'm saying is that FDR faced, you know, a horrible situation with the Depression. Reagan faced, you know, the 70s inflation, the horrible situation there. They both had – they're the two presidents who both had blowouts of their predecessors – and then big landslides when they were president for re-election. And I think we could be setting up for something like that because we're having that type of horrible situation here. We could have another FDR or Reagan, and Trump might actually be like Nixon was to Reagan, setting him up. And, you know, I mean, Nixon obviously had a blowout, like you said, in 72, 49-1. I think, I mean, certainly I like Trump. I think he might be the person to lead the party, but I also think DeSantis could be, too. He could almost be the Reagan of our party. He certainly is younger. He's only 43, 44 years old. He is actually getting stuff done in Florida, which is the new California for our state or for our country. I mean, that's like the California of the 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s.
Yeah, the gold rush,
Florida.
Yeah.
Yeah. So,
1840s. I know what you're saying. Yeah, in terms of destination. Yeah, thanks for the call, Frank. Yeah. No, it's interesting. I mean, history doesn't necessarily repeat itself, but it does rhyme. Clay and Wheeling.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. I don't have a wacky voice, just a strong opinion.
Okay.
That works.
We accept those.
Joe Scarborough's opinion ain't worth a velvet patent of a dolphin and a whale getting it on. It is useless, okay? And you know what? I've been called racist, homophobic, anti-Semitic, deplorable, every name under the book for the last, 6 years now? I could care less about some ridiculous question like that. In terms of McCarthy, what an insult to the name McCarthy. Bring back some real McCarthyism. I want these communist scum dug up, found, and like South Carolina just did, stood in front of a firing squad. I am sick of this stuff. I am excited for the next election. I love Carrie Lake out of Arizona. I gave her a few bucks. The last caller said DeSantis. I love DeSantis. I'm worried about losing him in Florida, though. I think Florida's too strong of a swing state, you know, and he's just killing it there. He is straight up killing it. So
thanks for the call, Clay. Appreciate it. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
It's like a hot, steaming cup of information to start your day. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So yesterday there was a Senate Judiciary Committee hearing on the DOJ's budget, and that necessitated that the effete Attorney General, who hails from the Northwest side, well, moved from the South side to the Northwest side. He's Merrick Garland. He was there to answer questions. Bill Hagerty, who's a Republican senator from Tennessee, raised the Hunter Biden investigation, and I'm glad he did, because we don't really have any indication whether there is or is one or still is one or where it's at or what's going on 2 years into it. And now after the New York Times has confirmed a New York Post story from a year and a half earlier about the laptop and its contents, Hagerty asked specific questions. Of course, Garland isn't going to answer specific questions, but at least he's on record as to the general structure of the investigation and a commitment as to that structure.
First, have you been briefed on the Hunter Biden investigation matter yourself, General Garland?
So the Hunter Biden investigation, as I said, even in my own nomination confirmation hearing, is being run by and supervised by the United States Attorney for the District of Delaware.
I'm aware of that, but he reports to you.
He is supervising the investigation, and I'm not at liberty to talk about internal Justice Department deliberations, but he is in charge of that investigation. There will not be interference of any political or improper kind.
Okay. And why should we trust you?
The president's already told his subordinates, clearly, that these are people that he can fire at will, that he and his family did nothing wrong. How can the American people be confident that his administration is conducting a serious investigation?
Because we put the investigation in the hands of a Trump appointee from the previous administration, who's the United States Attorney for the District of Delaware, and because you have me as the Attorney General, who is committed to the independence of the Justice Department from any influence from the White House in criminal matters.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's see if that passes the smell test for our old friend Steve Cortez.
Oh.
Former Trump advisor, former talk show host on our station, AM 560. He joins us now. Steve, thanks for being with us. Appreciate it.
Good morning, Dan. Good morning, Amy. Appreciate it.
So what about Merrick Garland? I mean, I'm not necessarily so inclined to take Merrick Garland at his word, but his point about this is in the hands of a U.S. attorney from Delaware who was a Trump appointee. Do you have confidence that the Hunter Biden investigation will reach some sort of conclusion in our lifetime?
You know, I do not, unfortunately. I wish I could say otherwise, but, call me cynical. The fact that it's taken this long, the fact that we are 6 years into this saga, there's a phrase that justice, is a dish best served cold, or revenge is a dish best served cold. I don't think that's true when it comes to actual jurisprudence in the United States. We need swiftness when it comes to justice in this case. Will it be eventually rectified? Potentially. I mean, it's possible, and, hope springs eternal. But would I bet on it? No. Quite frankly, I would not. And the thing is, so far, the only people who have paid any consequences at all have been pretty minor actors, let's face it. We need major people. I mean, people with names like Comey and McCabe. We need those people in handcuffs. Is that going to happen? Unfortunately, Dan, I don't think so.
What about Hunter in handcuffs?
Sure. Listen, I think at the very least, he broke FARA laws, right? The Foreign Agent Registration Act. I mean, at the very least, he broke that, you know, and broke it a lot. But the thing about Hunter, too, is I never loved the political focus on him, because Hunter, I view in many ways, is a really troubled soul who was manipulated and exploited by his father, right? Like, the true criminal is not Hunter. It's Joe Biden, right? It's the big guy. It's the guy who turned his son, who had a problem or a lot of problems, who turned his son into effectively a bag man for the Biden cartel, for what was an international criminal enterprise. The main beneficiary, you know, the head man, the tutti capo of that Biden cartel was Joe Biden. It was the big guy. So, you know, is it helpful to have Hunter Biden handcuffs? Perhaps at some point. But my point is, he's not really the person that America should be concerned about. It's the person who is currently in the Oval Office.
Yeah, but he's a means to those ends, is my point. I mean, you know, work up the food chain.
Sure.
Well, then what about Biden's or Hunter Biden's associate that was, you know, went to see then Vice President Biden at the White House? Is there anything nefarious there?
Right. Oh, listen, I think there's nefarious activity everywhere, you know, regarding this whole episode. And by the way, you know, the most damning part of the whole enterprise, other than what the Bidens actually did themselves, other than what Joe, big guy Biden did, you know, regarding collecting his 10% from the most dangerous adversaries in the United States all over the world, the most dangerous episode for the country, I think, you know, outside of the Bidens themselves, is what big tech did to hide this story. And we still, I don't think, have really grappled with that as a country, right? The fact that there was a digital iron curtain that descended upon America. Tens of millions of Americans never even knew about this story because it was totally censored, because Twitter shut down the official social media accounts of the Trump campaign, shut down my social media account at that time, because Google took down from YouTube every video that even referenced this story at the time, because Facebook had in its algorithms programs where you literally could not share the original New York Post reporting on this issue. So big tech, unfortunately, was very effective at hiding this entire story at that time. And even if you believe that the 2020 election results are accurate, and I certainly do not believe that, but even if you believe they are accurate, polling shows us that enough Biden voters, had they been informed of this story, would have changed their votes to more than change the outcome of the election, to make sure that Donald Trump would be president of the United States today. So there are so many aspects of this that are troubling. Certainly the tactics and activities of the Bidens themselves are very troubling, very corrupt, and very criminal. But I think even more important than that for the country is the fact that all of this was hidden. All of this was hidden by big tech, and unfortunately, kind of effectively so.
Yeah, well, now they're going to institutionalize that disposition with their disinformation boards and all these federal agencies. But I wanted to get to 2022. We were just talking about that before Mike Scott's newscast at the top of the hour. And what Republicans can look forward to, what conservatives can look forward to, if Kevin McCarthy becomes Speaker and Mitch McConnell becomes Senate Majority Leader again in November. And you suggest not very much.
Right. Well, listen, I hope and I do expect, honestly, that if we elect really America first candidates to the Senate and the House, and we send a lot of stalwarts, a lot of fighters, that the caucuses that serve underneath that terrible leadership of McCarthy and McConnell will force those leaders into positions that they would not take, you know, on their own volition. But nevertheless, I've been incredibly critical of both of them. And recently wrote an article on my Substack where I called them vipers within the tent, and I really believe that that is who they are. McConnell and McCarthy in no way are America first. They do not believe in our vision. They are not populist nationalists. They are clearly establishment Republicans who are far more concerned with power than their own personal power than they are with the agenda of America first. And by the way, you know, to be specific, speaking of tech, when it comes to McCarthy particularly, he is a California Republican who very well represents the interests of Silicon Valley. I mean, that is just the reality. And the idea that he is going to truly take on big tech in the way he needs to, the idea that he would engage in trust busting, for example, against big tech, I think it is not in the cards if he is, in fact, Speaker of the House. Now, I think, unfortunately, he's probably going to end up as Speaker of the House. I'm doing everything I can to prevent that. And I encourage the audience out there, I encourage the deplorables out there to work against him, because I think it would be a real shame that we take back the House and install him as Speaker. But at the least, we need to elect a lot of America First fighters so that his caucus will pressure him in ways that he does not like. Because I think both McCarthy and McConnell are swamp sewer dinosaurs, quite frankly. The two of them have served together a combined 52 years in the United States Congress, and they are firmly part of the Washington establishment. They are not part of our movement.
Well, I don't know if you see what's happening in California this morning. They're putting up billboards in McCarthy's district that says, it's a picture of Kevin McCarthy, and says, you know, quote, "We heard the tapes, Kevin. Stop lying about January 6th.
Well, and you know, that's interesting, Amy, because McCarthy has accomplished something sort of, you know, unique in a way. He has equally alienated the far left radical sort of MSNBC Rachel Maddow crowd, right? They can't stand him because of these tapes. But at the same time, the America First populist right can't stand him, right? So he has really successfully made enemies with these tapes and these revelations, you know, with both sides. And by the way, getting back to big tech, one of the things we learned in these tapes is that he literally said to Liz Cheney, right, to a complete traitor, another viper within the tent, he said to Liz Cheney, "I wish," and he was speaking of his own members, of Republican members of the House, he said, "I wish they would be censored on social media." So he wanted more censorship of his own members, of our representatives, of people like Marjorie Taylor Greene, who are fighting for us. He wanted more censorship of them for big tech. You know, we found out from those tapes what I think a lot of us suspected, you know, but now we know factually, you know, who he actually is. And I think Rachel Maddow, who's not somebody I'm used to praising, I think she did the country a favor. And I think she did America First a favor by revealing exactly who Kevin McCarthy is. How he speaks privately is very important and very pertinent for our movement. And it's part of why I think he's just totally unfit to be the next Speaker of the House.
Well, so a couple of things. One is, you know, Trump was asked about McCarthy's comments on the tape and basically said it doesn't change the relationship. I thought Trump has grown a little bit recently, because the rally that they had in Delaware County, Ohio, in which J.D. Vance was featured, somebody he's endorsed for that Senate seat in Ohio that's vacant. You know, he said, yeah, J.D. Vance talked smack about me. But if I base my endorsements on only whether or not you talk smack on me, then I wouldn't be able to endorse anybody. You know, everybody talks smack about me. It was sort of self-effacing. I thought it was a nice moment. And you can talk smack about me, but if you're going to commit to the policy agenda I followed as president, then I'm going to support you. That's I think, the right posture to take. And so with respect to McCarthy, I see it sort of in the same light. It's like, oh, they're weighing the options. These are you know, guys that are trying to plot for their political future, and I understand what motivates them, and so, you know, it's just part of what you have to deal with as the president of the United States, and particularly my presidency. And I thought he sort of showed a lot of maturity in both of those, and good humor in both of those instances, and I think it serves him well. So if that's Trump's posture, why shouldn't it be the Republican rank and file's posture?
Sure. Listen, I understand that reasoning, but here's the difference. And by the way, I'm in Ohio right now campaigning with J.D. Vance and a lot of town halls with him. We are barnstorming all over the state trying to earn votes from Ohio citizens. And I think he's going to be the next senator from this great state, and he'll be a fantastic one. But here's a key difference. J.D. Vance said things as a private citizen in 2016 that were very critical of Donald Trump. When we're talking about Kevin McCarthy, we're talking about the House Republican leader in 2020, right, just 2 years ago, literally saying that Donald Trump should resign. So to me, that, you know, that's apples and oranges. I mean, those are not comparable scenarios. Private citizen Vance 6 years ago saying bad things about Trump and then coming around once he saw the policy agenda of Trump succeeding, I think that speaks very well of Trump, that he's willing to look past that and recognize who J.D. Vance is today. When it comes to somebody who had real political power, you know, significant power at the time, At a moment when Donald Trump, let's face it, was at his weakest in those couple of weeks after January 6th, those tapes, most of the tapes that were revealed were on January 10th of 2021. At that moment, Kevin McCarthy saw it fit to stab the president in the back privately and then publicly came out and defended Trump and went down to Mar-a-Lago and kissed up. That to me is not forgivable. It's not something we can look past. It's not something where Kevin McCarthy had a bad moment or Kevin McCarthy came around. No, Kevin McCarthy showed us who he really is. And he is a corporate stooge. He is ruled by big tech. He is a dependable ally of big business in this country. He is a Republican establishment globalist.
Although, when McCarthy said earlier this year that it's time for the Republican Party to decouple itself from the Chamber of Commerce, you don't take him at his word there? You don't think he'll actually follow through?
Absolutely not. And listen, and this is part and parcel, unfortunately, of how McCarthy and people like him operate. They say the right things, sure. He understands he's not a dumb politician. Clearly, that's how he got into leadership. He gets America first, and he knows how populist the movement is and where the voters are. So he pays lip service accordingly, and he does it quite well, I would say. But when you actually look at his actions, when you actually look, in this case, at his statements, which he didn't know would become public someday. I'd love to know, by the way, who made those public. I have my own ideas, but I'm not sure. I don't think it was Liz Cheney, by the way. I think it was somebody else. But regardless, he has never denied the veracity of these tapes. They're not doctored. It is Kevin McCarthy. We see
right.
who he is. So,
yeah, right.
I do not believe his public statements, for example, about taking on big tech. When you look at his actual actions, when you look at his team that he has assembled of big tech lobbyists, and again, in a certain sense, I don't almost fault him. He is representing Silicon Valley, and he's doing it very well, from their standpoint. I'm just saying, as an America First adherent, he is not fit to be the leader of our movement. He is not fit. He does not have the credentials to be the Speaker of the House and to take that mantle of leadership. And I think that was already evident, but it has become blatantly obvious given these revelations from these tapes.
Well, what's President Trump think about these tapes from McCarthy, and what's their relationship like?
Yeah, listen, I think they've always had a tested relationship, right? It's always been, one of suspicion, but an alliance of necessity between the two. And so far, it seems like President Trump is going to stick by him. So, I don't agree with that decision.
Well, but I mean, for him, I mean, he's looking at 2024, I presume, and he's saying this isn't the fight to pick right now. We don't need division. We need to be focused on the midterms. We need the big numbers in the House and the Senate and, those sort of intra-party contests for leadership posts can happen later. But it doesn't serve his interests or, frankly, the Republican parties for them to have a big public fight about it.
No, and by the way, I think that does make sense. That's exactly correct. For now, at least, Donald Trump's view probably is, and I'm not spoken with him about this, but his view probably is that this isn't a fight worth picking right now, from his perspective. But I think it is for the American people. In other words,
yeah, I understand.
I think for voters, we need to demand of representatives that they're going to run for Congress and that they are going to elect an America First Republican speaker. For example, I think somebody like Jim Banks from Indiana would be fantastic. There are other people out there who would potentially be in leadership. I think everyone in leadership right now is compromised, in my view, whether it is, Scalise or McCarthy. I mean, Elise Stefanik, all of them, in my view, are totally compromised and unfit for leadership. So I think we need to look outside the present crop and look at the rest of the crew. And if we're going to elect whatever the number is, we're going to have 250 Republican House members. There are two or three or four, I think, excellent members who could potentially be a far better speaker. And I think you're right. It may not be advantageous for Trump to intervene in that selection process and in that potentially fight. But I think for our people, for the deplorables, it's imperative, really, that we do consider carefully who should be the speaker. And in my view, it cannot be McCarthy.
Before we let you go, you're close to Trump. What's your intuition as to 2024? Is he going to run again?
Yes, listen, he's running. I mean, not that he's made any official announcement, of course, but I 100% expect and believe in my private conversations with him as well as his public statements all indicate that he is running. And I hope that I'm going to help him win for a third time. He won in 2016. He did win in 2020, and we're going to win in 2024.
Steve Cortez, former Trump advisor, former talk show host here on AM560. Steve, thanks as always. Appreciate it.
You bet. Thanks for having me, guys.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
You're listening to Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. A parent nation, as I see it, is a society that cherishes and supports the love and labor that go into nurturing, raising, and educating future generations. There is no limit on who can provide that love. So when I say parent, I mean any caring adult entrusted with the raising of a child. Those are the words of Dr. Dana Suskind. She is the founder and co-director of the TMW Center for Early Learning and Public Health, director of the Pediatric Cochlear Implant Program, and professor of surgery and pediatrics at the University of Chicago. And it's, that's part of the thesis of her new book, Parent Nation, Unlocking Every Child's Potential, Fulfilling Society's Promise. Dr. Suskind, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me.
You know, I mean, I hear what you're saying, but boy, I'm a little jumpy about the redefinition of, well, everything, starting with parents, as we're having this more than semantical spat about whose children are they when it comes to K through 12 education, with the President of the United States, with the President of the United States saying yesterday that you know, they're our children, they're your children when they're in your classroom, and then they're our children outside the classroom. So address that a little bit more, please.
Sure. Well, really, I want to clarify that my focus is on the first 5 years of life. When really, when I say it's a broad definition of parent, this does not mean that parents are the parents, right? They're the ones who are doing the nurturing and the labor and love, but I don't want to leave community off the hook. Mm-hmm. So I make it a broad, you know, grandparents are critically important, you know, aunts, uncles. So it's more that parents, even in your definition, in my definition, deserve support, right, to be able to do the things that they want to do and to lead with their family values. But I think we've all seen with COVID, especially in those first few years of life when, you know, parents are really struggling because, you know, the little ones take a lot of time, they're often left on their own without the support that we all need from employers, from community, I know you're talking about in the more political realm. I'm really talking in the family values realm in, you know, supporting mothers and fathers. And I see so many, I've talked to families from across the country, you know, an evangelical mom who all she wanted to do was stay home with her baby, but couldn't because her husband, who was a student teacher, didn't make enough. So she had to go back to work to Starbucks. So that's really what I'm talking about.
Okay. And so tell us, so the first 5 years of life that you focus on, what is it that you're trying to get parents to think about that they're not thinking about at present or not thinking about sufficiently?
Well, I think it's the fact that our country is based on family values. Our country is based on parental choice, right? We can all agree that parents should have the choice of how to raise their children. But we make it so hard on parents in those first 5 years of life. I mean, as I mentioned, you know, from Star, who grew up in an evangelical home, to Talia, who's a PhD, who, you know, spent all these years, you know, who wanted to work outside the home but wanted to be able to afford childcare, which cost the amount of, you know, a mortgage or a college tuition these days. She couldn't, you know, fulfill her dreams of how to parent. So it's really those first 5 years of life that when the brain development is the most rapid. I mean, all, you know, K-12 is critically important, so this is not about saying K-12 isn't, but we just haven't invested as much in those first 3 to 5 years of life. When 85% of the brain is developed, when you have a million neural connections, look, now I'm talking like a doctor and a scientist, but neural connections are happening. This is the basis of all, you know, your whole future. It's not everything. It doesn't end there, but that's exactly when we don't invest and we don't support parents. I mean, you know, you've seen parents are really, they're doing their best. All parents want to just do right by their kids. And I think that our communities and society and employers can just do a little bit better job or a lot better job in supporting them.
But like what? I mean, give me some examples. What could they do differently?
So do you want to talk policy or do you want to talk, all right, like an employer,
policy.
Right?
Yes.
What are some of the things that employers could do? Flexibility, right? Star, who I mentioned, who's went back to work at Starbucks and now works as a paralegal, she said, you know, sometimes it's hard to bring my full self to work because, you know, a babysitter cancels. And just having a greater understanding of that or reliability, being able to have, you know, high-quality childcare, getting support from employers from that, from policymakers. I mean, honestly, the fact we are literally the only country of developed nations without paid parental leave, right? One in four moms have to go back to work within 2 weeks of giving birth to a baby. Really? Is that family values? I mean, I don't know about you, but 2 weeks after giving birth to a baby, how can our nation allow that? So these are things like paid parental leave, and this has bipartisan support. So this is, you know, so I'm like so tired of everything being put in right or left. We're one country, and we all care about our kids. And most people, you know, quote unquote, both sides of the aisle, believe that mothers shouldn't go back within 2 weeks. We should have paid leave, right? That if you're going to put your baby, or you have to go back to work, or you go to, or that's your preference, that you should be able to put your child in a high quality environment, right, where they're getting that nurturing interaction. Those are the things that I'm talking about. That's a country that's really focused on putting families and children at the center. Do you agree or disagree?
Well, I mean, I don't want to go down to the rabbit hole of paid family leave. We'll do that another time. I want to more focus on your professional expertise as a pediatrician and
sure.
with respect to brain development.
Yes. I can talk to that too.
Yes. Well, good, because I can't. For the purposes of emphasis, talk a little bit about what you understand both as a medical doctor and practitioner, what you've seen, so the experience combined with the knowledge, about those first 3 years and the importance of that brain development and the impact it has on future learning and so forth.
Yeah. So I'm a pediatric cochlear implant surgeon, and really my work focused on the first 3 years of life came out of the fact that I started seeing differences in my patients' outcomes after I gave them a cochlear implant, which is the ability to hear. And really trying to understand why these differences, I came upon this incredible, powerful science that shows that in those first 3 years of life, parent and caregiver talk and interaction, just talking and interaction, that nurturing interaction, is building a child's brain. And I realized in my research and the broader research that what I was seeing in my patients who are deaf really mirrored the larger population, that in those first 3 years of life, language and interaction builds a child's brain. And parents and caregivers are the brain architects, if you will. And so my research at the TMW Center at the University of Chicago really focuses on helping parents and caregivers understand just how powerful they are and helping give them the tools for getting their children off to the best possible start, which is what all parents want. And so this next book really takes that same idea, because I saw over and over again how parents embrace these ideas, but, you know, their worlds were so hard, right, that, you know, they were working, you know, two or three jobs and never home with their kids. So how do you put that into action? And so really this next book asks, you know, what does a society look like that really centers on parents and caregivers as the brain architects and the healthy development of all children?
So what's the one she's...
We got to jump. She is Dr. Dana Suskin, founder and co-director of the TMW Center for Early Learning and Public Health, director of the Pediatric Cochlear Implant Program, and professor of surgery of pediatrics at the University of Chicago. The book we were discussing, yes. Parent Nation, Unlocking Every Child's Potential, Fulfilling Society's Promise. Dr. Suskin, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. And she joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
If you're talking about it, Dan and Amy are talking about it. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Root causes for violence. Root causes for violence. In American society generally, in minority neighborhoods in big cities disproportionately. We talk a lot about the breakdown of the family and out-of-wedlock births, lack of fathers in homes. That perhaps, I think, pretty convincingly is part of it. Another part of it may be the violence that kids see starting in the womb. Perhaps the elimination of family members begets some of the violence. There's a Democrat state rep in Connecticut. Her name is Trine McGee. She's a black woman. She's a Democrat, to repeat for emphasis. And she recently spoke to some pro-abortion legislation that's pending in the Nutmeg State. Here's what Representative McGee had to say.
One of the most triggering words to me is access. The second is equity. Because the number one reason why a lot of my colleagues believe that this bill should be passed was because they felt that black and Latin women, and this is national, black and Latin women lack access to reproductive health care. Black women make up 14% of childbearing population, yet obtain 36.2% of all reported abortions. Black women have the highest abortion ratio in the country, 474 abortions per 1,000 live births, percentages that at these levels illustrate that 19 million black babies have been aborted since 1973. 38% have been performed on black women, but black people only make up 12% of the population. What I learned was that Margaret Sanger, who is the creator of the Birth Control League, which became Planned Parenthood, had an extreme passion for eugenics. What she decided to do was to go into the black community door to door. She knocked on our doors and told black women that they could get an abortion. One of her most famous quotes is, "We do not want word to get out that we want to exterminate the Negro population. And the minister is the one who can straighten out the more rebellious members if it ever occurs to them to revolt." Not only did she go door-to-door in advocacy within the black community, but she did birth control testing on women in Puerto Rico. And so women for generations were unable to give birth. So that's why we've never lacked access, because we were the prime target for why abortion should be legalized.
Yeah. She's spot on, as we've documented on this show before, that ghoul that founded Planned Parenthood, Margaret Sanger, and the ghouls that run it to this day. And the ghouls that finance those abortion mills. And maybe there's something to that. What do you think? Maybe there's something to not promoting a culture of life that begets generations, some segment of those generations, that also see no value in life, the ones that survive. For more on all of this during National Crime Victims' Rights Week, pleased to be joined by Sylvia Bennett-Stone. She's the director of Voices of Black Mothers United, which is a project of the Woodson Center, our friend Bob Woodson in D.C. Sylvia Bennett-Stone, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Good morning, and thank you for having me.
What did you think of what Connecticut State Rep McGee had to say?
Well, I typically, don't get into that aspect of violence, and I do call it violence. However, I think that abortion is a personal decision, but you cannot go into it as being a victim either. It is a personal decision. Now, how it was promoted into the black community, I'm just going to tell you, I'm not, I don't know. Okay. I don't know. I would just say I don't know.
Okay.
But I will say, as it relates to what she was saying, all the way around, we have to take personal responsibility and make some good decisions for ourselves individually.
And so, you know, with this Crime Victims' Rights Week upon us, what is it that you want people to be thinking about as our nation's big cities continue to set generational records for violent crime coast to coast?
We have to, again, make some personal decisions and say, I can't take this anymore. Enough is enough. And if I start doing something about it, perhaps my family will do something about it. My neighbor would do something about it. And then we can slow down the violence in terms of bringing collective solutions into our communities, taking back our neighborhoods one block at a time. If that means us marching down the streets to get rid of the drug dealers, you know, they don't like attention. So if that means us giving them that attention that they do not want, then let's do that. Because it must stop.
And you know, the leadership, I mean, this is such an interesting organization, because this Voices of Black Mothers United that you head up, because you're talking about mothers who've lost children to violence. So they have a unique perspective, a terrible experience, and a unique perspective on this problem. It's very real to you, and you're in a very, I mean, and you have a unique way to convey the reality of what's happening on the streets of America.
Absolutely. The ones who are mostly affected, as Mr. Whitson said, are the ones that have the solutions. We are able to turn, we as mothers, are able to turn our pain into purpose. And what that does, it allows us to live, because that's an unnatural pain that you deal with, right? But if you take your focus off that pain and look and care about the next child, and saving that next child's life, you don't have time to think about your pain. But we do have plenty of time to think about that purpose, and that is bringing safety to the communities so we won't have to continuously attend these candlelight vigils and do all the routine things that's become so common when a child dies.
Well, are you surprised? Yeah, that Black Lives Matter isn't out there, you know, when there's black on black crime, specifically in, you know, big Democratic cities like Chicago. They're not out there protesting that, or, you know.
I'm not surprised. I'm not surprised at all. They made it very clear that that's not their agenda. Their agenda is to bring about this movement of defund the police and all of that. Our agenda is caring about our people and the fact that we are killing each other at a record number, and it must stop. So, no, I'm not surprised.
So what does your organization do? Say, you know, somebody just lost their child. What do you guys do?
The first thing we are advocates. We're certified advocates, actually. So therefore, we're able to go to that family. We know exactly what that family is feeling at that moment. So we try to meet them the first thing and get them in a place to where they're calming down. They can deal with it the best that they can. They can make some rational decisions and help them not to make certain mistakes. I know I didn't have a roadmap, right? So So there were certain things that I should not have done, but I did. There are people that come to take advantage of you. We try to help them recognize those type of things, be that roadmap for them. Secondly, Voices of Black Mothers, we are community advocates. We bring about community intervention. We bring about different programs that bring awareness to the fact. We help them. We help communities develop solutions that best work for their community for safety issues, right? And thirdly, we promote positive policing. We do not, absolutely do not, support the defund movement. We were one of the first to come out and say, no, we're not going to support it. And it was a different stance that we took because we are Black mothers just saying we want the police in our communities. We need the police in our communities.
Yeah. What is some response that you've received? I mean, they can't really confront you. I mean, what are they going to say to a mom who has lost a child to, as you lost your daughter to gang crossfire? What are they going to say? They're not going to criticize you. So they try to ignore you, it seems.
I do get criticism.
What do they criticize you for?
How could she? She's a Black woman,
Oh, right.
That kind of thing.
Straying from the orthodoxy, the flip side of
you
that. The flip side, have you and your organization, Black Mothers United, have you received support from any unusual suspects, any places you didn't think you'd receive support for your particular angle on this issue of trying to increase the peace?
I think those that we receive support from are the ones that we expected. We are looking for and waiting for mainstream media support to where it can get out to the masses. But there's other ways of marketing and telling our stories. So we're using innovative approaches to that. But just about everyone, when you're individually talking to people in the community, support us. They're
right.
Saying you are absolutely right. We are tired and we have to do something.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but in the 15 years or so, I guess, 18 years since you lost your daughter. Have you seen a change with the work that you've done? Do you see things improving at all? Because obviously the statistics tell us that things aren't improving, but that's not the whole story. Have you seen sort of pockets of hope where you think there are some things that are afoot that could be positive and could start to reverse the course in some of this violence?
I do. I see that, and I'm totally optimistic anyway, but I see that the people themselves that's within the communities are saying, okay, what can I do? What are some of the solutions? We want the solutions. Just help us, guide us, point us in the right direction. So that in itself is a huge win that we recognize that this has gone too far and it's too rampant, it's too widespread when a six-month-old baby is shot in a car seat driving down the street.
Mm-hmm. And what do you think?
That could be any of us.
Well, then what do you, in your opinion, what is the purpose of Black Lives Matter?
Okay, so what I would repeat is their agenda, and they say their agenda is to bring racial equality to the masses as it relates to police. That's the only thing I know.
She is Sylvia Bennett.
I just don't want to speculate what their agenda is, but I'll say what they say.
She is Sylvia Bennett Stone, Director of Voices of Black Mothers United, a project of the Woodson Center in Washington, D.C. Sylvia Bennett Stone, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. And she joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
This is the morning show. More Chicago radio listeners are choosing. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Right now, the market is up. It opened up based on some good earnings report from tech companies. We'll see how the market processes the GDP number from Q1, -1.4%. That's called contraction. That's called a one quarter of contraction away from a recession, and the implications that follow. For more on all of this, on the implications piece of it, pleased to be joined by our friend Jim Perry, SVP of Arbor Research. Jim, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Dan, and thank you for having me.
So nobody was anticipating negative, much less this negative. What? How will the market process it, and what does that mean in terms of the financial landscape going forward?
Right. Well, it's funny, you know, every time we get a negative number, the headlines are a surprisingly weak number, right? That's part of the bullish narrative that you get on the TV stations for the business channels. The Atlanta Fed does a GDP forecast, and it's been negative for a month and a half. So, and I think the last time you and I spoke, I told you I thought we'd be lucky to have GDP at zero. So it's not really a surprise, and I would suspect that going forward, you will see negative GDP prints in the quarters ahead.
Well, when was the last time we were here with negative GDP?
Well, it's funny. People kind of forget. But, you know, in the fourth quarter and the third quarter of 2019, before the pandemic, we were going into recession then. And that's when the Fed in September and October began their fourth wave of quantitative easing, which we called QE infinity. the repo market collapsed, and the Fed bought $1.5 trillion worth of treasury bills. So we were going into the recession before the pandemic, right? And then, of course, the first quarter and second quarter of the pandemic year were deeply negative numbers, which bounced back solely because of government stimulus.
And here we are now with the reckoning starting to manifest itself, the idea that you can run the printing presses forever with no consequence, the idea that you can replace a private economy with government transfer payments. The rubber is starting to meet the road, is it not?
Absolutely. This is the end of free money. The higher rate certainty that has been given us as messages from Jerome Powell is here. We had a 25 basis point hike last month, and on May 4th, they're going to aggressively hike again, 50 basis points, maybe more, also on June 15th, also on July 27th. The market's got a 225 basis points of Fed tightening priced in into Q4. That's a lot.
And so you expect the market to react negatively to this over time, like for the rest of the year? Are we looking at NASDAQ was at a 52-week low yesterday. Are we looking at new lows as far as the eye can see?
Well, there's a little bit of an oversold story today. But, yeah, I mean, you know, higher rates and aggressive rate hikes are coming. And the great risk unwind has begun. And to your point, you know, artificially established low interest rates and free money causes problems that people don't really think about until it's here. I was thinking about this last night. There's a great quote from Ernest Hemingway in a book that he wrote called The Sun Also Rises.
Right.
And one of his buddies exclaims that he's gone bankrupt. So Hemingway's character says, well, how'd you go bankrupt? The guy says, well, gradually at first, and then suddenly. So the point is, this has been coming for a long time. It's just all of a sudden showing up. The stock market you know, the NASDAQ down 22% already this year. The S&P's down 13%. And the Russell 2000's down 22%. So this has been going on since January, November, December, January.
And so we were talking for the first part of the year about whether or not inflation was transitory. And then the Biden administration and Jay Powell decided to stop suggesting it would be transitory. And now it seems we have to add the stag to the inflation and ask if stagflation is going to be transitory. Are we going to see two quarters of negative growth, or are we going to be beset by stagflation for an extended period of time?
Right. The economy around the world is slowing dramatically, and that is a direct effect of the conflict in the Ukraine. And that conflict has caused two things to happen. I mean, you know, the supply chain story from 6 months ago and 9 months ago, that was about semiconductors and laptops, right? This one's different. This is about energy and, more critically, food, right? Mm-hmm. So there's a food shortage on the planet, and that's going to give social instability a little bit of a boost. And the higher energy prices, you know, that is nothing but inflationary. So we are going to have global food and energy inflation and goods inflation as long as the pandemic exists and the lockdown exists in China. And the Europeans are going to have to cut back on their Russian oil, and it's going to take them some time to do it. So,
well, and then the response from the central planners is going to be what? It's going to be more transfer payments and more tinkering. So,
right.
I mean, that's
right.
More likely than not to be the response. So how does that not extend this negative environment?
Right. Well, look what happened in the last 6 weeks here with the Japanese yen. I mean, I know it's a little bit slightly esoteric for the average investor in this country, but, you know, the dollar is on a rampage here because the currencies of China and of Europe and Japan are absolutely collapsing. And last night, you know, the Bank of Japan said they're going to do whatever it takes to buy 10-year JGBs, which is the 10-year government bond of Japan, and keep rates artificially low for as long as it takes. And as they do that, the Japanese yen is absolutely collapsing. And the Japanese, to their credit, you know, they've been trying to inflate their economy for 30 years, right? And they have not been able to do it. And by letting the yen collapse here, they get an opportunity to finally inflate their economy. So this is the chance of a lifetime for the Bank of Japan. The government and the central bank there have to be absolutely thrilled that this is happening. It's more stimulus. And the Chinese stimulated yesterday again, too. So, and the Europeans are still buying government bonds, right? So are we ever going to really get out of the nanny state of government money printing? Probably not. But here, it's going to stop immediately because Powell has promised the administration that he would do everything he can to get prices down for the average American consumer. And that's what's going to happen. The Fed is going to tighten aggressively. This is why the dollar is going up and all these other currencies are going down.
Well, speaking of Europe, I mean, today, you know, Russia cut off natural gas supplies to Bulgaria and Poland. What is that going to mean? Should we gas up today?
The sanction and Russian gas story in Europe is very, very complicated.
Okay.
The Russians are trying to force Bulgaria, Poland, and everybody to pay for gas in rubles. And the reason they want that is because they don't have dollars, right? They don't want oil to be traded, and the Chinese do not want oil and commodities in general and technology to be traded in dollars. So he's trying to get away from the dollar regime as a global reserve currency. And frankly, there's nothing economic about that plan. I don't know who he's talking to over there, but this is just not going to work. So his only choice is to say, well, I'm going to cut you off. And as you can see from the Germans and the Italians, they're starting to say, we are going to quit bringing natural gas and oil in from Russia. We're going to need a few months or maybe a half a year or a year to do it, but we are going to do it. So I think recession in Europe is a certainty. A depression in Russia is a certainty. A severe contraction in China is a certainty. And now you've got a global synchronized systemic recession here. And for the first time ever, the Fed is going to tighten into a global recession, this is just not going to end well for risk assets. It's impossible.
And you were talking about currencies too, you know, so it's really risk assets. So crypto, what are we learning about cryptocurrency in this environment so far?
Well, the Bitcoins is trading just under 40,000, which is kind of where it's been for, you know, a year. It's been between 35 and 45,000 for 12 months. And what's interesting about it is it's beginning to correlate quite directly with the NASDAQ, right, as a risk asset. And the reason for that is that the Bitcoin is going to work. Now, just like we knew that the laptop was going to work 30 years ago, but we don't know what blockchain technology will be the currency of choice in this new world. Governments, central banks, central clearing banks like JP Morgan, they're all against this stuff because they lose power, right? So you're going to see a tremendous amount of backlash from the SEC and from the Fed and from the Treasury Department about, you know, the concerns of a Bitcoin and fraud and criminal activity. But the bottom line is, you know, you look at the earnings of Microsoft, for example, last night, cloud computing and business enterprise software using blockchain, as we've talked about, Dan, many times on this show, the growth rates in the blockchain are exploding. And that's all paid for by cryptocurrency. So they're going to be here. And eventually, do you see regime change from the dollar because of an electronic currency? You know, I'm not an expert. But I would say, you know, at some point in the future, maybe it's a half a decade or a decade, I think you're going to see the world understand how to work an electronic currency that can avoid central clearing. So, yeah, I think everybody should own some. I don't know what it's worth. Maybe it's worth only 5,000. It's probably overvalued right now. And I'm not even sure Bitcoin is going to be the cryptocurrency that survives, just like we weren't sure, you know, a Commodore computer or a Sun computer was going to survive.
Right.
They're all spectacularly out of business.
Right.
But there will be a protocol of cryptocurrency and electronic currency transfers that will be the next generation's go-to exchange rate, for sure.
And then what happens, in your estimation, in the housing market? You get a wide array of opinions on this. You would think it would be sort of obvious with interest rates increasing. But it's not obvious because, you know, it may be very uneven where you continue to see home prices increase in sort of certain enclaves while there's a reckoning in other parts of the country.
Right. If you live out in the suburbs of Chicago, it's a seller's market, right? And I think that's true in most of the Sun Belt and low tax states. And the real estate market has benefited tremendously because of the rise of inflation and also because of low, low interest rates. We've never quite been here before, but both of those two things are not going to exist in the present form within the next year. So my fear on the real estate market is that higher interest rates are going to reduce new mortgages, right? The mortgage data came out yesterday, new mortgages are down 9% from a year ago last year, right? Just yesterday, right? So the fear is that all of this cheap money has allowed private equity money and venture capital money to go in and buy large, large chunks of real estate, condos, apartment buildings, housing development. And they're doing that, Dan, with free money.
Mm-hmm.
Now they have to have the cash flow to service that debt. And that debt is going to get more expensive. So there are going to be speculative areas of real estate in the next quarter and two that are going to crash spectacularly, mainly because the era of free money is over. And that is going to create a great unwind in all of the weakest links in the chain. That's going to be credit spreads, mortgage rates, leveraged loans, private equity real estate. You know, I can go on and on. The tech companies that don't have any money. I mean, the carnage in the stock market is hidden. They always say that averages hide more than they reveal, and nothing could be more true today. I mean, some of these stocks like Peloton and all these things, they're down 80-90% from the highs 5 months ago, right? These companies are going to go out of business. And the fear is that all the retail investors that have got money in ETFs and indices, they're buying all this stuff and they have no idea what the risks are. So if they feel like they need to unwind those positions because they're down 30%, you're going to get a liquidation.
He is Jim Perry, SVP of Arbor Research. Jim, thank you as always for your insights, even though they are not encouraging. But we do appreciate your expertise. Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir. Bye-bye.
Bye. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Listen to Dan and Amy on your smartphone. Download the AM560 mobile app today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.